Welcome to the 2013 ASCIPAW Sober Troops panel. My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also an active duty Air Force member of 8 years and a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. Please help me open this workshop with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always to maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker, or indeed any AA member, be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential to our effort to keep other problem drinkers who may wish to share their recovery program with us, and our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. The long form of AA's 11th tradition says, our names and pictures as AA members ought not be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. In keeping with this principle, please do not post recognizable photos of identifiable AA members on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social networking sites. I would like to introduce our panel leaders. First off, we have Brian. Second, we have Aaron. And then third, we have Charlie. I would now like to invite our first panel member up, Brian.
Brian, alcoholic.
Brian.
Sorry, let me put on my little timer right here. As a sober troop in AA, I look back at my military experience and how it's affected my sobriety, and I see a lot of good things and I see a lot of bad, and that's what I'm going to share with you today. And when I became an alcoholic and I initially recognized it, there was nothing in my past I could see. You know, this was the turning point. There was nothing when I was younger or that happened overseas or anywhere in my life that I felt like this is the reason I became an alcoholic. I believe I became an alcoholic because at some point I stepped over that invisible line, and that craving and that obsession and that need for that feeling and that effect that the alcohol gave me, you know, changed me to become an alcoholic. And, you know, two things about, like, for me growing up when I was little, you know, I had a good life. I was, you know, supported everything I wanted. You know, I got all the video games I wanted, all my basic needs and all my needs were met. All material needs. My sister was a drug addict when I was little, and watching through that and seeing my sister use and abuse drugs and see what she did with my family, you know, I said I'm never gonna be like that. And growing up throughout my life when I was little, I was pretty much a golden boy. I never dabbled in anything. Until high school, I smoked a little weed, did a little pot, and drank a little bit of alcohol, but it was nothing too great effect. And then also when I was growing up, I also felt this, like, in my life, growing up as little as, and still today to some point, like, I've always felt like I was on the outside looking in. Like, I was never a part of. Like, I could be in a room full of all my friends and all these people, yet I still don't feel that connection that you guys have with each other. I don't feel that love. I don't feel like I belong for some reason. And then And those were like my feelings as I was a kid, is no matter what, you know, no matter if I was doing good in sports or if I was on this team, or with this club, I still didn't feel a part of it. And then, growing up, I've always wanted to be in the military. At the age of 17, I joined the U.S. Army. And, for me, that was a great experience. It's something I love and something that's still dear to my heart to me today. I'm very proud of it. But when I went into the military, I went in at 17. I went in at a very young age. I didn't really understand exactly what I was doing at that age. I knew I was fighting for my country and I was doing all these great things, but I didn't see the whole picture like I do today. And when I went in, I went through basic and I got assigned to, I was infantry. I got assigned to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, 101st Airborne. I was with the Rockassons, if any of you guys know that unit, the most famous infantry unit there is in the United States military. Sorry, Marines. So I got there and I was young, and the first thing I get when I get there is, you know, I can't deploy, I'm too young. So I finally get deployed, and when I get deployed, I go to Iraq the first time, I go up north into Crit, and I get assigned to our recon platoon. So I get placed in sniper section, which is this great opportunity because I was young. I've never been really trained military other than basic, so there's nothing bad that these guys have to fix. Like, they're gonna train me how they wanna train me, and they're gonna teach me how they want me to be taught. And I lived that lifestyle, and these guys were older and families and, you know, different stages in their life, and that's what I clung on to. I clung on to this group of people that, you know, pretty much I feel like these men raised me, and I learned to live like them, and I watched what they did, and I did what they did. And, you know, in the military, there's a lot of drinking and stuff like that. So, when we got back from deployment, we'd go out and, you know, we'd have a few drinks here and there and meet. You know, I didn't have a problem. You know, I kept on and, you know, I was fine. And, you know, I felt a part of in that unit. And initially when I first got there, a lot of the guys were older because of the type of experience you have to have in that, the sniper section. So when I got in there, I remember like a month in, we're going out to eat. Chow in the morning, because we do night missions. We're going out to chow in the morning, and as we're walking back from chow, my section leader slams my breakfast out of my hand, and like just starts hitting me, and I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And then we get in the Humvee and we drive back to where I'm where our housing is on base, and I go in my room and I'm like trying to calm down because he's just picking on me. I don't understand why. Like, what's going on? And then he comes in the room and he just starts just smacking me in the back of the head and pushing me. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And it got to that point where, you know, I was very timid and very relaxed as a kid that I was like, I'm not going to take this. And I freaked out and I like literally grabbed this 220-pound big, huge dude. I mean, everyone was on steroids back in that day. And just like drove him through the door. And I was like, oh my God, what did I just do? And then he like reached his hand up at me, grabbed me by the face and said, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I wanted to see. And for the first time in my life, I felt acceptance like I've never felt before. I was finally a part of. I did that thing and that made me feel like the group. You know, I felt like I was finally in the middle of the group and I finally felt like this is where I'm supposed to be at. This is, you know, just, this is where I'm supposed to be. And this are my friends, and, you know, I felt that bond. And a bond greater than I've ever felt before at that time. And I go on throughout my military career, and I come back on my second deployment. And, you know, this is kind of where I start dabbling in drugs and alcohol. But during my military career, like I said before, you know, I drank here and there occasionally. It was nothing out of control, nothing crazy. Never got DUIs, never got in trouble. And then for some reason when I came back that second time, I crossed that invisible line where I wanted to drink like the other guys because I saw these guys who are older who've, you know, been in the military for a while, and they're looking at me because I can't put back a beer or save my life. But, you know, I start practicing at it because I'm military. I want to be like these guys. So I sit in my room at night and I drink, I get a 30 pack and me and my roommate, we split the beers and I drink 15 beers. That night I pushed myself to drink 15 beers so I could drink like the other guys. Cause even though I feel a part of, I want to feel more a part of. And like, eventually I crossed that invisible line. And, the alcohol then to me became to a point where it's like, that effect it produced on me was great. Cause after my second deployment changed a lot. When I got back from my second deployment, my bunkmate that I served with over in Iraq, took his life. Also had, other friends die and other things. So when I came back from that second deployment, like there was a lot of things that were kind of different than from my first that I felt affected, in a different way. When I came back, I was numb. I was just emotionally, physically numb. It was like I was walking through the world, but like there was no connection with it. Like I was just going on with my routine. And when I ended up drinking and I felt the alcohol hit me, you know, I felt that effect. And for some reason that numbness went away and I felt this inner peace, this inner sanctuary. I felt that effect and I felt whole again and I felt great. And, you know, I got out of the military and it just continued down this long, long road and it just ended up getting worse. It cross addicted into other things and, this soldier who could once, you know, be a leader of people who could, you know, be on time to work every morning and, you know, do all these things was no longer that person. My family didn't want to talk to me. I blew all my money I burned in the military. I stole a lot of money from my parents, from other people. I pushed all my friends away. I got back and when I moved back to Arizona, I didn't feel a connection to anyone. I came back here and I felt like these guys don't understand. Like my friends don't understand. I'd come out and I'd hang out with my friends from high school and like I'd be in there and like I'd have small talk with them, but like there wasn't that connection that I had with the guys in the military. And I don't know, it just, I ended up after like 3 months back, I just self-isolated. And after 2.5 years, because of pride and ego, you know, it took me about 2.5, 3 years to come in these rooms and finally admit that like I need more help than I can do myself. Coming in these rooms was not easy for me. I struggled a lot with it because when I came out of the military and I had this addiction, I said, you know what, I've been to Iraq, I've been to war, you know, I was infantry, I was on the front lines. These are the things I've seen and I blame my addiction on that. I didn't blame my addiction that I'm an addict because when I put drugs and alcohol into my body, I have this effect. I said, I'm a drug addict because I've seen all these things and that's why I messed up. Even though I see these kids who are 18, 19, 20 years old, never did anything with their lives, but they had the same addiction as me, I was better than them because I had this great life before me that they could never understand. And because they never walked through the steps that I went through, you know, I separated myself from the people in the program when I first came in because they never walked my path. I never looked at the fact that when they put drugs and alcohol in their body just the same way that I put drugs and alcohol in my body, they had the same effect produced, that same physical allergy, that same phenomenon of craving. And it took me a while to realize that. But when I finally checked in, I finally went to a rehab center and I stayed for 2 weeks before I moved to sober living. And you know, I finally decided that all right, I understand that like I still had the pride, I still had the ego that separated me from my others, and I still didn't feel a part of. But when I looked at the steps, I looked at it as like, you know, I can't live this life anymore because I see what's going on. I see that my friends in the military who got out or who are still in are still struggling with this and they're killing themselves. And I don't want to do that because I don't want to do that to my family. I don't want to do that to my loved ones. So I take these steps and I look at it as like a mission. Like this is something I need to do and I need to continue doing because I don't want to fail. And for me, like when I look at it like that, like I'm able to see, all right, this is what I need to do. This is the order I have to do them. And I work at it. And I work harder and harder and I make sure I do it, you know. And you know, that was a relief for me. You know, I finally got through the steps, and when I worked this program, I worked these steps, a lot of those things, you know, started to be lifted away. My anger towards other people not feeling a part of, it left me. To sit here today and say I sit in a room with all my friends and feel a part of, that's not true. I don't feel a part of when I walk in rooms, still to this day. But through the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized that what my perception isn't reality. And I know that I'm a part of, but it's my disease that blocks me and my ego that blocks me from the people in my room, not my military experience, not the things that I've walked through in my life. And the big book has definitely made me realize that and helped me cope with that and learn how to be friends and meet other people. And, you know, it's been a huge, huge adjustment. And like when I work these steps and I do what I'm asked, you know, the military helped me in this. It gave me discipline. I need to know I need to be at a meeting. I'm at the meeting. If I need to know I have to meet with this guy, a sponsor, no matter what, I'm going to meet with him and do step work. If I have to, you know, have a service commitment, I'm going to be there early and make sure it's done. And it's gave me that discipline, you know, to continue to strive on. And even through the tough times, when I've had tough times in my sobriety, because, you know, I'm in my sobriety, things are great, I have this great connection with God, but still life is up and down, and when I'm in those down moments, I still have that perseverance to carry through and know that, like, at the end of the road, like, it's going to get better. And that's how my military experience has helped me, because I knew, like, when I was overseas and when I was in the military, there was a lot of tough times, but as long as I pushed through, things would eventually getting better. And when I bring that into my program, it helps out a lot. And you know, just recently, you know, I've been going through the steps again. Just went through the steps for a second time. And when I went through the steps with this person, my sponsor, Ben. No, so like when I went through him, I got to look at a lot of things, because I never, like, the thing is with me is I never shared a lot about my military experience and the stuff that I've done, and I was able to clear a lot of that stuff that I carried with me from overseas, and a lot of it was just anger and hate, and from that. Clearing that stuff away, I met a friend in this program. And that friend just so happens to be Iranian. And before, just becoming from what I've been through, I would have never been friends with this guy. I would have looked at him and turned the other way and probably said a few slurs in the process. But when I was able to clear that stuff, I met this new friend, and this friend is probably one of my best friends in the program. He's actually been helping me through some things I've been going through recently. And through that, I've had one of the most amazing spiritual experiences I've ever had. He's helped me with these things I was going through, and I got to write these letters to people, and I got to find that, like, all these things that I was going through and struggling with aren't really, you know, they're just my perception. They're not reality. And it's been an amazing experience going through these steps and being able to change my perception, just not about the program or my military service, but about the world around me. And I'm over time, but I don't know. One of the best things I've ever heard in this program, I'll hear it again, and I'll say it. This guy Larry T says he's from California, this is kind of why I continue to persevere. And he says, "I can never get so sober that I can't get drunk again, but I could get so drunk I can't make it back." And I'll pass with that.
Thanks, Brian. We'll now call our second panel member, Aaron.
Hey, guys. I'm Aaron, and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to say thanks, and it's definitely an honor to be here. I'll have to admit, I've been a little nervous on what I'm going to talk about. I've been so busy for the last couple of months, just to where I haven't even had a chance to stop and take a breath. And you know, just to start with that, it's, you know, I started a new job and just moved into a new house. And, you know, it's things that without this program wouldn't have even been possible before. And, but it's amazing that, you know, just coming into an AA meeting here, just as soon as I come in, how I'm able to just slow down and just kind of catch my breath and, you know, see life through a completely different lens again, instead of letting all the stress and everything just build up. And when Brian was talking, there was quite a bit that I could relate to. I had originally gotten sober when I was 16. I started drinking and doing drugs probably when I was about 12, and I mean, I knew right away it was I was just off to the races. And both my parents were recovering alcoholics, and they both went into treatment when I was born, so I had never seen them do anything. And but they had always just planted those seeds throughout my whole life of, hey, here's the red flags to watch out for, just so you know. And you know, I definitely was very, very lucky to have that, because immediately I could identify with the stories that they were telling. You know, whether I cared or not, it was a different matter. But you know, right away I knew that I was heading down the wrong path. And you know, come 16 years old, I still was doing well in school, and I was in sports and everything. I was real active, and but you know, just inside I was just getting all torn up. And you know, so I said, hey, I need some help. And I ended up going to treatment. And you know, so I went to meetings and stuff like that, and you know, I'd hear the stories of the people who had the divorces, they had the bankruptcies, they lost everything, everyone hated their guts, you know, but none of that ever happened to me. And you know, I felt like a pretty smart guy, to where I was able to stay ahead of the disease, and you know, catch it and nip it in the bud before anything like that happened. And so that was my attitude in AA, was, you know, I was the smartest guy there, and you know, I knew everything. I knew all the right things to say. I might not have acted on them, but I could sure say them. And you know, so I stayed sober for about 7 years. And in those 7 years, so for the first 3 years, I was going to meetings and everything, and going through the motions, and you know, telling everyone at the meetings how much I knew, and not doing any step work. After those 3 years, I stopped going, and you know, I started living with drug dealers. I had my best friend had committed suicide, and I started to go down the depression path, and I ended up being in an adult foster home, ended up becoming homeless. So I mean, a lot of things were happening in sobriety, and I use the word sobriety pretty loosely there, because you know, I was basically dry. And you know, in this time too, I had some felony theft issues, and you know, so I wasn't able to really get many jobs. And so it just so happened when I was 21, I got off of probation, and it was always something where I thought I wanted to do it. You know, I didn't want to get older and regret not joining the military, so I decided to join the Marines. And you know, so I went in and I did the infantry, and you know, I stayed sober in there, and I should say dry again. And up until about a week before I deployed to Iraq. And well, actually probably 6 months before that, I started living with a corpsman, is what we call, like, medics in the Marines. And he started prescribing me Ambien, so I started taking that every night, and taking that and staying awake. And so I can't really say that I was even dry at that point in time, but a week before I went to Iraq, I just started drinking. And it was funny, because I naturally gravitated, my group of friends were the heavy drinkers, and I mean, even in the Marines, like, the other people looked at them, were like, yeah, they drink a lot. And once I started drinking, they were like, whoa, like, I mean, it was crazy that I just did not miss a beat after 6 years. And And so, you know, I drank for that week before Iraq, and so I had that stuff in my system again. I had that nasty alcoholic thinking. I was in the heat of it, and boom, I get shipped off, and I have no drugs, I have no alcohol, and I'm just going crazy in my head. And you know, there's no fix, and a lot of downtime over there, you know, in between doing missions and stuff like that. And you know, the one thing that I found that kind of kept me out of it was just, you know, keeping my nose down and just stay busy doing, you know, just basically becoming a workaholic. And you know, like Brian was talking about, the one thing I got from the military was a lot of discipline. You know, I can get a job done, it's no problem, but it becomes a problem when I just get the tunnel vision and I just focus on that, just so that way I don't have to deal with the other things. And you know, I got back from Iraq, and just every day, just go straight out to my car in the parking lot, just sit there and just drink vodka right out of the bottle. And you know, I did that for a while, and no one was there to really catch the warning signs, just because all my peers were doing the same thing. But you know, I tried to get sober. I did an outpatient treatment thing and the Marines, and then so I got clean, and then about 3 months later, I went on a different deployment where we just so happened to stop at Thailand. We got off the Navy ship, and so I immediately relapsed there. And it was actually, I was just telling Tricia beforehand the story. I had gotten separated from my group, and I was so wasted. And so it was a pretty big deal if you get separated from your group that you're supposed to be like your battle buddies out there. And so I was walking around drunk, just asking random people if they knew how to get back to the hotel where we had to go check into. And they're like, yeah, actually there were some Marines that were showing your picture around town. And I was like, wow. I was like, so do you know how to, they're like, yeah, they said just go back to the Hard Rock Cafe. And I was like, you know, would you mind showing me where it is? I'm so drunk, I can't find it. And so, you know, we're walking there, and they're American. And so it's just kind of weird to see them in Thailand, and they weren't military. And so I was like, oh, what are you guys doing here? And they were there for the international conference for AA. And, yeah. So I was just like, wow. I was like, you guys would not believe this. Like, I just relapsed today. Like, you know, look what condition I'm in. So, you know, like, good on you for not being in my situation here. And, but it was really crazy just to see, you know, how, I mean, you can go anywhere in the world and, you know, there's AA there to help you out. And, needless to say, fast forward, it was a lot of bumps of trying to stay sober when I was still in the Marines. And if anyone's still doing it in the service, that's, I mean, hats off to you. It's a very, very hard environment, and I struggled a lot with it. And you know, I got out, and as Brian was talking about too, the adjustment was just so crazy coming back to civilian life. And I'm not from Phoenix. I moved here. Didn't really know anyone, and it was the crazy Iraq behavior, I guess, didn't really come out until I was surrounded by civilians. And you know, because everyone, you know, when you're still in the military, you're still, everyone around you is doing the same stuff, so you don't really notice it. And it was a very lonely feeling, and it was very hard to relate to anyone, to let my walls down. And you know, I mean, like a normal day, you know, I'd come home from work, from school, and I'd have to first thing run on the door and just slam a beer. You know, it was like my life depended on it, just to like alleviate the stress. And it was just nonstop, just the shakes. And so, I mean, I just knew I couldn't live that lifestyle anymore. But you know, for me too, it was coming from the military background. It was really hard to, lack of better words, accept defeat and say, you know, I can't do this anymore, because, you know, the whole thing ingrained in me was just, I can do anything, you know, just give me the challenge and I can do it. But it's, I just felt like such a failure for doing it. But, you know, looking back in retrospect, it's more of, I was the failure, and I, you know, I was giving up if I just continued to drink. I have a friend who's still in the Marines. He was in my unit, and, so he's been struggling with the treatment thing, and he just could not do his third step for the life of him. And, you know, he just felt like it was just the biggest sign of weakness of giving up control. And he's like, you know, I just feel like I'm taking the easy way out. And I was like, honestly, like, after you do the third step, like, there's no easiness about it, you know, in the program. And it's definitely been a lot of hard work in the program, but it's definitely paid dividends. And I've developed so much just in sobriety, where before no one trusted me, no one wanted anything to do with me. I was too hungover to show up on time for things. No one trusted me with stuff. And, you know, now I'm a CPA now. You know, I just had a house. I have a beautiful girlfriend. You know, before I was just a rolling stone. I didn't want to have any ties to anything. And, you know, it's, so I have these things, but, you know, the one thing that really has really stood out the most is not the job, you know, the material stuff. It's the 9-step promises, which I'll read to you, because that's the thing that really just stands out the most for me looking back and the sobriety. And it's on page 83 in the big book. It's, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And so, I mean, all those things are things that I'd seen in sobriety. And I guess just the ability just to sit still and completely, irregardless of what's going on in my life, external things, just to be content and be happy and be grateful, it's truly been a miracle. It's, my entire life has just been, the theme of it has been, I just cannot stand sitting in my own skin, and to not have that be the issue, to just, you know, be happy just regardless. And I guess another thing too is just the humility from the program, of just kind of accepting myself for who I am and not having to be anything I'm not. And I guess put that image out. It's just been a huge freedom for me. And so I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, but I appreciate you guys letting me speak here, and I'll pass.
Thanks, Aaron. I'll call up our last speaker, Charlie.
I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. I feel good being here and seeing you guys today. So my story is a little different. When I was in the Army, I was drafted. They had a draft years ago. This was like in the 60s. And the day you turned 18, you had to go to the draft board and register. And if you didn't, they'd get you. You know, I don't know how they knew, but they would get you. So I signed up for the draft, and it was during, you know, the Vietnam War. So, I mean, most people I knew did not want to go. You know, there were people going out to San Francisco, to Haight-Ashbury. There were some people going to Canada. But there's no way I would do that. You know, I'm originally from New York City, Queens, and from an Irish Catholic neighborhood. And if you left or did something like that, you don't come back. You know, you just don't. It's really, you know, it's pretty much a redneck area. And like these guys, I started, you know, drinking and drugging real early, you know, 13, 14 years old. And you know, it just progressed. And in New York, I mean, they very rarely arrest anybody there if it's just for possession. I mean, you know, heroin, you know, they'll let you go. I think you have to shoot a cop or something there, because the cops don't want to mess with the paperwork and all that stuff. So a lot of stuff really gets slid. And for me, it was good because I was never arrested and I never really had any problem. So as my alcoholism and addiction progressed, I was in high school, and I don't know how some people can do it. I really don't. Some people can go to school and use all this stuff and do good. You know, I mean, get through. There's no way I could do that. My partying and my chemical use increased. You know, I'd show up for school, but I wasn't, I really wasn't there. It was more of a social thing for me. And so, you know, I'm 17 years old. I'm thinking, holy crap. There's no way I was smart enough to go to college. You know, like a lot of people went to college and they got a deferment, you know. There's no way that it was going to happen for me. So what I tried to do was I tried to stay in high school. That's what I tried to do. I was in high school for 6 years and never graduated. And I got so messed up, they finally just kicked me out. I was 19 when I was kicked out of school. And I was kicked out like in May of 1967. And by August, I got my draft notice, you know. And in New York, what they do is, at the time, they give you a subway token so that you can't say, well, I couldn't make it, you know. So they give you a subway token to get, to have your, you know, your physical and all that stuff. And I didn't know anybody who was turned down, really. Guys with psych problems, you know, guys with all kinds of issues. Oh, yeah, okay, you're going, you know. And of course for me, you know, that was it. And I was inducted, I think it was like September of 67. And I always laugh, people would ask me, well, you know, was it the military that drove you to this? I mean, I went into the military strung out, you know. I mean, I had to withdraw my first 2 weeks. I was sick. And the guys I was in there with, they did what they could. I mean, I'm 19 years old, so I was healthy. And like these guys said too, one thing that the military really did for me was discipline. It really disciplined me. You know, in basic, if you didn't do the deal, they made you stay. You know, they'd keep you like another week or two, and you just didn't want to do that. After about 4 weeks of basic, then you could go to the PX and start drinking. You know, 3-2 beer. Has anybody here ever drank 3-2 beer? I mean, it's like water, you know? It's like you gotta drink a case or whatever. I mean, we drink a lot of it, but it didn't seem to work, you know? So I got back started at that point, and then, I had my friends sending me stuff too. I mean, how crazy was I? I don't know. You know, if they found it or whatever. I really didn't think of any consequences. And I brought a lot of stuff in with me when I first went in. I got through basic. I wasn't like these guys, you know. They ask you your first day in there, you know, like the induction, what do you want to do? I mean, they're going to do exactly what they want with you. If you're drafted, forget about it. You're going to do what they want. If you enlist, then you could get, you know, infantry or whatever. And so that first day I said, well, I want to be a cook, you know. And sure as hell, I finished basic and that's what I was going to be, a cook, a spoon, you know. We call them spoons, and nobody messed with the spoons. You just don't, you know. I mean, they think you're going to spit in their food or whatever, which I'd never do anyway, you know. I mean, I just wouldn't do that. But everybody respected the cooks. And so this is during Vietnam, and I'm finishing my cook school. They actually send you to cook school. I still don't really know how to cook today. I can cook for 200 people, but I can't cook for, you know, for two or three. You know, it's just really insane. So I was finishing training, and luck would have it, there was a big incident in Korea, South Korea. They stole a ship of ours, of the Pueblo. This was like in January 1968. And January 1968, everything went crazy in Vietnam. That was the Tet Offensive. I mean, they just attacked everything. And but for a few weeks, they started sending people to Korea. They started building up, you know, Korea. And so I lucked out. I mean, you know, there's no way I was going to volunteer for Vietnam, man. You know, I'm basically a chicken now. And but I got sent to Korea, and there's really like a lot of troops there. You know, there's still a lot of troops, and there was a lot of troops then. You know, the Korean War was 1950 to 1953. So I get over there, and I've been drinking and partying all the way. You know, all the way through schooling and everything, and didn't get into any trouble like in the military for some reason. I one thing my dad told me, he goes, in service you keep your mouth shut and you don't volunteer for nothing. And I was like, all right. Well, it was really good advice. I remember basic training one time, sergeant came in, he goes, how many of you guys have been to college? All you guys raised their hand. Come on with me. I mean, we saw them chipping paint off one of the buildings and stuff. You know, you just didn't do stuff like that. So I get over to Korea, and in Korea, anything goes as far as drinking and chemical use. You could go into any Korean pharmacy and get anything, you know, tranquilizers, amphetamines, barbiturates, and you know, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. But alcohol was really cheap too. I mean, really cheap. They, you know, I think about it today, and I'm like, geez, was it that way? They would have happy hour, and they'd, for 1 hour, there'd be, you know, the mixed drinks were 5 cents. 5 cents. Cigarettes were like 10 cents a pack. No tax. So I started in, you know, I really started, I started partying, and I did have trouble, you know, like getting up in the morning, and I was stationed in Incheon. It's kind of up north, somewhat, and during that time, I had a seizure. You know, an alcoholic drug seizure. I mean, that's what it was. I was right out there. And so what they did on our base, if you screwed up, they would send you further south. You know, kind of like F Troop. Does anybody ever remember that? F Troop. I mean, that's actually what it was like. You know, all these duds and whatever. So the next thing I know, I'm being sent down further south, and with a bunch of guys who were had screwed up, you know, had done crazy things, and that's where I was. So, and there was only like 25 guys on our compound. We supplied petroleum for the whole country, you know, all kinds of stuff, and but it was really easy. I mean, it was simple. We had a little PX, and we had a nightclub where, I mean, every day we would go in there. Every day we would go in and get loaded. You know, it was cheap, the whole thing. And I'm just trying to think. So yeah, I think the only action that I saw there was we'd get loaded, and as a group we'd go downtown, you know, and chase all the Korean girls. You know, I mean, That's exactly what it was. There was an off limits area called VD Alley. I got caught there Christmas Eve. Coming out. It wasn't going in. It was coming out. There was a guy in our compound that had a venereal disease 16 times. 16 times. And what what they would do there, if you had it once, you know, they give you a shot of penicillin, you're restricted for 1 week. If you have it twice, it's 2 weeks of restricted. So what people do after they have it twice, they go out in the village and have someone give them a shot of penicillin. I mean, it's really insane, you know, because you don't know what the heck is happening. So anyway, there was really like a lot of partying and getting through and but I was able to get through, you know, for some reason. And I met a bunch of guys, you know, you do stick together, you know, like you go downtown and I always remember the people on the compound who didn't drink, you know. There was like a few guys who were married who would send them, you know, their family their money. And I remember thinking, God, what the hell is wrong with those guys, you know? What the hell are they doing? They're just sitting around doing nothing, you know? And we're all partying and getting wasted, and it was just insane. And it was getting, you know, like towards the end of my thing there, and I remember thinking, damn, you know, it's this military, you know, that's what's screwing me up. I'm in the military and it's crazy here, you know, I everything's so easy, you know, and I gotta get back to New York. If I get back to New York, I'll be okay, you know, so of course, you know, I eventually got discharged, an honorable discharge. And you know, this was the summer of 69. You know? I know, it was a pretty rough summer. So I came back. I had a problem with drinking and drugs. I just continued right on, you know, through the whole summer. And it was really pretty insane. And, you know, physically, I got really, really shot. In like 3 months, I lost like 30, 40 pounds. And I couldn't tell, you know, I couldn't see myself, you know, my ribs looked like, you know, they were shrinking in a little bit, and I knew I was in trouble, real trouble, when the people I was hanging with, and one of the things I think that we all do is we hang with people that are doing the same stuff that we're doing, you know, I mean, I want to look around and see that it's normal, you know, geez, I'm not as screwed up as him, I'm not as bad as him, you know. So, of course, that's what I was doing, the same people I was running with before I went in. But I knew I was in trouble, I really did, but I really knew it when the people I was drinking and drugging with were telling me that I needed to go to rehab, you know. When your using friends tell you that you're screwed up, it's like it's time to do something. And, you know, for me, it was, I got to the end where nothing worked, you know. It didn't matter what I did. It didn't matter how much I drank or how many chemicals I used. It stopped working. And this was like the beginning of August of 69. And at that point, I knew I was through. Isn't that crazy? I mean, I knew I was through because I had money, I had everything I wanted, all the chemicals, all the alcohol, and nothing worked. It stopped working. I was drinking to pass out to sleep. I didn't want to be awake. You know, I didn't want to be conscious. And I'm thinking, holy Christ, it's only going to get worse, you know? I mean, what the hell can you do? There wasn't a lot of rehab around it. AA, I didn't hear anything about AA. I got, you know, I reached a point where it didn't work. And, you know, one of the things that happened in 1969 was the Woodstock Rock Festival, which I did attend. Yeah, I did. I was there for 3 days. I only remember three bands. I was in a blackout almost the whole time. The whole time. And, so I get back. I had a girlfriend, and you know, she was getting sick of me. You know, my family was sick of me. I was losing her, and the chemicals weren't working. So things were really closing in. You know, like my whole life was closing in on me. It's like, God, I really have to do something. And I remember going to my mom and dad and saying, I really need some help. You know, I can't do this. I really need help. What they did is, you know, they spoke with a friend of the family who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he had been in there a long time. And I went in and saw him, you know, and I knew the guy. And I talked with him, and he said to me, "Do you want to do something? I said, "Yeah, I want to do something." I mean, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to get the hell out of there. So he said, "Are you willing to go to rehab?" Yeah, I'll go to rehab. I'll go to, you know, my using buddies were telling me I should go all along. So I went out to Minnesota, you know. It's the land of 10,000 lakes and 10,000 treatment centers at the time. Now this was in 1969. Oh, one of the things that happened, you know, that summer was, it was when we first landed on the moon, you know, in 69. I think it was July, maybe. I didn't find out that someone landed on the moon until like October. You know? I mean, I was not present. And I think, like a lot of us, those last couple of weeks, I was isolating myself. I wasn't around anybody. And the last week or so, I was in and out of blackouts. You know, I grew up close to the ocean in Queens, and you know, I was finding myself waking up on the beach all alone. I wasn't with anybody. I just, you know, people didn't want to be around me. I found out later, you know, I'm one of 12 kids. There's 8 boys and there's 4 girls. I'm the oldest boy. I found out later that my brother, who's a few brothers down from me, was following me. I would go out and he would follow me until he saw that I was okay. And I, you know, like, I didn't find that out till later, so I must have just been in some ozone or something. But I finally went to rehab. You know, I finally, you know, I got in there and I got real sick. You know, I'm still young. You know, I was 21 years old, but I was yellow. You know, by the time I got in there, I was yellow. You know, I was jaundiced and sick. And then they didn't give me anything to withdraw. Nothing. And the only thing they gave me was a drug called Dilantin, so that I wouldn't have seizures. But for 3 weeks, I was like sick. I mean, I was like really couldn't sleep. I had like electrical currents going through me, like it's like I was being zapped, you know. I couldn't eat, and then finally one day I had a restful sleep. You know, I woke up and I felt good, and holy mackerel, you know this. But I still didn't know what to do. I knew that. I really knew in my heart that this stuff was never going to work again. I knew it, but I was 21, you know, and I thought, man, this is bullshit. You know, I'm 21 years old, and I gotta quit using. I gotta quit drinking for the rest of my life. You know, I really didn't like the idea, and I was in rehab for 11 months. I mean, they kept me like a long time there, and then I went to a halfway house for 5 months. But in that time, I'm talking to my counselor. I'm going, you know, I mean, yeah, it's easy to stay sober in here. You know, I mean, there's nothing here. There's not a bar over there. There's not all kinds of crap around. And he said to me, "Yeah, but you don't have to be here, though. You know, you're here on your own choice. If you wanted to walk out of here right now, you could walk right down into a bar and get loaded." And, you know, that really made sense to me. You know, like, I really was doing this. It was my decision to stay there, you know, I started getting over that, but I thought, well, all right, I know I have to quit using all this stuff, you know what I mean? It wasn't good, but why can't I drink wine, you know? Why can't I drink a bottle of Ripple? Does anybody remember Ripple? I don't know, it's really a nasty wine. It tastes like, I don't know what the hell it tastes like, but it was really cheap. And I was thinking, why can't I drink a family-sized bottle of Ripple? You know, every day. And my good friend, who I was in rehab with, he goes, "No, you can't do that." I mean, you know, why? it's a drug. Alcohol is a drug. And I think, God, that is really bullshit, you know. Because I knew it. And I said, well, I don't know if I can do this. And this was like, you know, 3 months into it. And he said, all right, stay sober for 1 year. Stay so, don't use anything, stay sober for 1 year. And if you want to use anything after the 1 year, go right out. Go right out and do it. But you got to really give it a shot and meetings and that whole stuff. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And, you know, by 6 months I knew I had to stay sober. I knew I had to be straight. You know, I just, you know, seeing people in detox all the time, seeing what was happening, and I really started to listen. And this treatment center was a 12-step program too. You know, you had to go through your steps, you know, your fourth step. I did a really good fourth and fifth step. I remember the priest said, the only thing he hasn't heard in a fifth step is a successful suicide. That's the only thing he hadn't heard. So, you know, and of course, we had to put down the stuff that bothered us the most right away. You know, you put that stuff down and you get that stuff out right away. And, you know, I really felt good after that. And they started taking us to outside meetings and you know, like after a while, you know, the people in the meetings aren't full of shit. I mean, you know, you can pick out the ones who are just screwing around, but the ones who are doing it, you can see it after a while. And I knew that I wanted what those guys had. I mean, I wanted that freedom. You know, I didn't want to have to drink and use chemicals all day long. I wanted to be a free person, and I knew that I wasn't a free person. I was not free, like I'm sure all of you haven't been free. You know, if you've had a problem with alcohol or drugs, you weren't free. And so I'm going through rehab and I'm thinking, yeah, I really have to do this. I mean, I know I have to do this. I was like, I was real depressed about things, you know, the whole bit, you know, my whole life was like insane. And in rehab I got my high school diploma, the GED. What does Chris Rock say about the GED? The good enough diploma. He goes, what do you get? You know, you get this thing in 2 weeks. Anyway, I got it. You know, I had to work for it and I got it. And I was happy about that. So I'm coming towards the end of my rehab. I'm thinking, damn, you know, how am I going to do this? And my counselor suggested that I go to a halfway house in St. Paul. So I said, all right, you know, that sounds good. It was a halfway house, like with about 30 guys. And half of the guys came from the Union Gospel Mission, and half of them came from rehab. But after a while, I knew the only thing I had on the guys from the Union Gospel Mission was that people still cared about me. You know, I still had a family. These guys had lost everything. Good jobs, families, and the whole thing. And I was able to see in those guys myself, if I didn't do something about it, you know, if I didn't stay straight. And I got a job in St. Paul, and you know, I was going to work every day, and I, you know, like I was out there, and I'm saying, hey, I'm doing this. You know, this is happening. I can really do this. And of course, how I was doing it was going to meetings, you know, doing a deal, going to a lot of meetings, connecting with people who wanted to do it. You know, my counselor said to me in rehab, he goes, stick with the winners, stick with the people who want to do it. Go to meetings and don't go in bars, don't hang out with people who are all screwed up. Stick with people who want to do it. And that's what I did. And you know, for me it just worked, and I've been really fortunate. I haven't drank or used since I went into rehab August 26, 1969. So I just celebrated 44 years. I mean, it sounds crazy. Yeah, it doesn't even. But I always come back to the important day is today. You know, this is the only day we all have. I mean, it's nice. It's nice that I've been sober a long time, and like I've heard in the rooms, you know, we can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. You know, we can't. It's today. And like I've heard here and heard people say, it really is. You know, it's a spiritual thing, and it's doing for others. AA is is for the newcomer. You know, and I was fortunate. For 35 years, I was an alcohol and drug counselor up in the Twin Cities, and that helped me too. Seeing people in detox, seeing people strung out, seeing people had seizures and stuff. You know, I mean, all that stuff helped me see that this is never going to work. That I can't go back and do it. And I had a family, five kids. You know, did the whole deal. Met my kid's mom in rehab. You know, that was good. We were together like 22 years, and then she went back out, and she's still out, you know, and I always tell people, you know, four of my kids were alcoholics and addicts, and my son wasn't, and he was adopted. I'm saying, the adopted kid was the straight one. Usually it's the adopted kid that's crazy, you know. He's adopted, he came that way, you know. My son is the normal one in our family. So, but, you know, my kids are doing pretty well. I still have two of them out there that are, one's in L.A. and one's in Chicago. And my daughter in New York is doing really good. My daughter here, you know, has a lot of medical problems. But anyway, I go to a lot of meetings. I do service work. I go to East Valley Inner Group. I did service work in Salt River Inner Group. I take a meeting into detox, you know, like once a month. I sponsor people. I volunteer at St. Joe's Hospital once a week. And it really is about giving and getting out of my head. You know, if I stay in my head too much, I go crazy. You know, I'm basically a selfish, self-centered person. And when I can get out of myself, I'm good. Are we done here? All right. It's really good, you know, seeing you guys. I sat in on the men's singing here. Those guys did a great job. They really did. So, thank you.
I'd like to thank our speakers one more time, Brian, Aaron, and Charlie. We will now close with the responsibility pledge. I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I am responsible. Thank you.